The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay. Now, I sort of raced through a little bit faster than I wanted to yesterday, the Holocaust. I want to just, before we go into what is going to be the last couple classes, are going to be dealing with Zionism and the history of the modern state of Israel. I wanted to read a little bit more, talk a little bit more about the Holocaust. One of the things I like to read is a very interesting quote, just to show you that Hitler's anti-Semitism was not his personal philosophy. It wasn't even the personal philosophy of the Nazis, but rather was in keeping with a earlier German philosophy from the 19th century. I want to read you, this is from Wilhelm Marr, who in 1879, he's the one who coined the word anti-Semitism, okay, to make hatred of Jews sound less religious and more racial. He connected the Jews with the Semites, but remember, keep in mind, anti-Semitism is not hatred of Middle Eastern Semitic peoples. Only a hater of Jews is an anti-Semite. You hate an Arab, you're not an anti-Semite. But Marr wrote a book called The Victory of Judaism over Germandom in 1879, which again went into a huge number of printings. It was a runaway bestseller. And this is not just the rabid ravings of some anti-Semite. He definitely is an anti-Semite, but when you read what he says, you can really hear where Hitler gets his ideas from. And again, he's not wrong. He's wrong in his reaction, not in his understanding. And I want to read a little bit of what Marr says. He says, quote, "There is no stopping them. Are there no clear signs that the twilight of the Jews is setting in? No, Jewry's control of society and politics, as well as its domination of religious and ecclesiastical thought, is still in the prime of its development. Yes, through the Jewish nation, Germany will become a world power, a Western New Palestine. And this will happen not through violent revolution, but through the compliance of the people. We should not reproach the Jewish nation. It fought against the Western world for 1,800 years and finally conquered it. We were vanquished. The Jews were late in their assault on Germany, but once started, there was no stopping them. Dear reader, while you are allowing the Germans to be skinned alive, I bow my head in admiration and amazement before the Semitic people, which is under heel. Resigned to the subjugation of Jewry, I am marshaling my last remaining strength in order to die peacefully as one who will not surrender and who will not ask for forgiveness. The historical fact that Israel became the leading social political superpower in the 19th century lies before us. We have amongst us a flexible, tenacious, intelligent foreign tribe that knows how to bring abstract reality into play in many different ways. Not individual Jews, but the Jewish spirit and Jewish consciousness have overpowered the world. All this is the consequence of a cultural history so unique in its way, so grand that everyday polemic can achieve nothing against it. With the entire force of its armies, the proud Roman Empire did not achieve that which Semitism has achieved in the West, and particularly in Germany." Now, he's not talking about Zionist occupation government. He's talking about the great ideological struggle of Jewish worldview versus paganism. Okay, and Hitler's trying to bring that, again, trying to resurgence of paganism in the world. So it's fascinating to see. He's saying very beautiful things about the Jews here. The greatest empires in the world, they're gone. They tried to kill us, they're gone. And Jewish ideology has played an incredible part in shaping the way the world thinks today, especially the Western world. Yeah, you have a question, Max?
I mean, you mentioned before, too, I think rightly so, that Luther was also behind this. I mean, his violence.
Yeah, Luther's anti-Semitism, though, Protestant anti-Semitism based on the writings of Martin Luther, was not based on his appreciation of Jewish impact on civilization, but rather his anger at the Jews, as we read previously, for rejecting Protestantism, which he thought they would follow. But clearly, when you can combine this kind of pseudo-racist, but this worldview, together with a deep-seated hatred of Jews that's based on Protestant anti-Semitism, it's easy to see, right? It's easy to see where. So that's why when a guy like Daniel Goldhagen writes his book, Hitler's Willing Executioner, which is so controversial, in my mind, there was nothing controversial about it. The fact that, you know, Germans were deeply anti-Semitic is to me an obvious point, that they may not have all actively participated in the Holocaust, but that they passively backed it is no shock to me whatsoever. I just want to read one more quote and we're going to move on, because I mentioned Lucy Davidovitz yesterday, who talks about the Holocaust as not a means to an end, but an end in and of itself. And I wanted just to read you, I mentioned this book, The War Against the Jews. She says it beautifully. And we have to appreciate what a singular event the Holocaust is in human history, especially in modern history. So this is from Lucy Davidovitz, The War Against the Jews, which is a book she came out with in 1975. "The final solution transcended the bounds of modern historical experience. Never before in modern history had one people made the killing of another the fulfillment of an ideology. in whose pursuit means were identical with ends. History has, to be sure, recorded terrible massacres and destructions that one people perpetrated against another. But all, however cruel and unjustifiable, were intended to achieve an instrumental ends, being means to ends and not ends in and of themselves. Like the Serbian slaughtering, whatever, is to get them out of their country. The killing the Jews was the ends. Then she goes on to say, serious people, responsible people, thought that Hitler's notions about the Jews were, at best, merely political bait for disgruntled masses. Yet precisely the reverse was true. Racial imperialism, fanatic plan to destroy the Jews, were the dominant passion behind the drive for power. Hitler's ideas about the Jews were at the center of his mental world. They shaped his worldview and his political ambitions, forming a matrix of his ideology and the an ineradicable core of National Socialist doctrine. They determined the anti-Jewish policies of the German dictatorship from 1933 through 1935, and they furnished the authority for the murder of the Jews of Europe during World War II. Few ideas in world history achieved such fatal potency. Very powerful book. But again, with the Holocaust, we're talking about the destruction of 6 million Jews at least. At least 72% of the Jewish population of Europe, and more or less the end of European Jewry. Doesn't mean all Jews cease to exist, obviously, but now we're going to see the focus we have to move towards is the next great period, which is, of course, the rise of the American Jewish population, which we already talked about is already a huge population, but the center of Torah Judaism is going to move to the United States following the Holocaust, clearly, where there's virtually nothing left in Europe today. The remnant, albeit a mere shadow of what it was, and also we're going to see Israel, the emergence of Israel as becoming a major center of Jewish population, the reemergence of a political entity, a national entity for the Jews, and also the reemergence of Israel as a major Torah center, which again is an unprecedented phenomenon in human history, that a people should go into diaspora and survive for 2,000 years, a nation without a national homeland, and come back again and reestablish a state. Albeit with all the problems that we've had, we have to appreciate is, again, another one of those great, miraculous, singular events in human history. No one ever did such a thing. And as I said many times before, the big problem with Jewish history is that we think our history is normal. And we look at it as like, yeah, no problem. We don't appreciate it. Only when we look at the grand sweep of all of human history do we realize how unusual these events are. The Holocaust, the diaspora, the wanderings, the reemergence of Israel, and again, often it comes through very indirect and strange means, not the way we would have planned it in our own limited wisdom, but in hindsight we see that it all works out. And certainly the reemergence of the State of Israel is one of the most interesting chapters in Jewish history. And we're going to spend the remaining time we have together going through Zionism, Israel, rebirth of the state, and what that holds for the future. To talk a little bit about, we left Israel really many centuries before. We haven't really said much about Israel since the Byzantine times, because since Bar Kokhba, we mentioned that Jews could not even live, I said, you know, Hitler introduced this idea of Judenrein, of Jewish free areas, you know, parks that Jews weren't allowed in, and cities and countries that there were no Jews in. But as I mentioned before, the first Judenrein city in human history was Jerusalem after Bar Kokhba in 135, when Jews were banned on penalty of death from living there. The Byzantines will follow that policy, the Roman Christians, all the way up to the early 7th century. More or less, there doesn't mean there'll be no Jews living in Israel, but no Jews living in Jerusalem. There will definitely be Jews living, and very significant Jewish population, during the Byzantine Empire. But as the Byzantine Empire goes into decline, in the 6th century, 5th century, 6th centuries, it starts to decline, the Jewish population is going to more or less disappear, because the economic situation and the lack of stability is not going to be a good environment for the Jews. So Jerusalem, as I've said before, will be, of course, central to Jewish worldview, but in practical reality, demographically speaking, Judaism, for certainly from 5th, 6th centuries, so the next 1,500 years, there's going to be very little Jewish population here. Now, just to jump ahead, and we've covered this before, but we know that in the early 7th century, the Byzantines, around 612, are going to lose Jerusalem to the Persians. And then, under the Emperor Heraclius, about a dozen years later, they're going to get Jerusalem back again, which is not going to last very long. Because then the Muslims are going to come and conquer Jerusalem. The Caliph Omar is going to conquer Jerusalem in 638. And as I mentioned, after that time, from 638 all the way through till 1917, we're talking about a 1,300-year period, the only break being the Crusades, specifically the First Crusade, which is the most successful, from 1099 till the Horns of Hattin in 1187. It's less than a 100-year break, but otherwise Israel is going to be under the domination of various Muslim rulers, some of which will actually put a fair amount of effort into making Jerusalem a very nice place, like the early Muslim conquerors, the Umayyads, in the very late 7th, early 8th centuries. They build, if you go down to the southern excavations, you can see the remnants of the Umayyad temple palace complex and the buildings they build on the Temple Mount. But Jerusalem, for most of the period of time, is going to be a backwater province of various Muslim rulers, whether it's Umayyads or Fatimids or Seljuks, Mamluks, Ottomans. And the later we go in history, by the way, the less effort is put into Jerusalem. So it's going to be not a particularly nice place, run down backward. None of these people had a capital city here. As I mentioned before, the only Arab Muslim city built in Israel that's not on the site originally of a Jewish city or town is the city of Ramla, which was the administrative capital for several Islamic dynasties in the Middle East. The Jewish population during this period of time goes up, goes down. We see for the most of that time there's not going to be that many Jews living in Jerusalem or Israel for that matter. There's not going to be too many Arabs living here for most of that time. The reemergence of a Jewish community takes place in a bunch of fits and starts. First of all, in 1210, we're talking about after the original Crusades, we're going to have several hundred rabbis of the Balei Tosafot. These are the descendants of, remember we told Rabbeinu Tam, we're talking about Rashi students, are going to start to resettle in Israel. This is the emergence of the first Ashkenazic, European community back in Israel. In the 13th century, we mentioned that the Ramban, I mentioned Nachmanides, that debate he has in front of King James of Spain with Pablo Cristiani. I mentioned that before, right? That he comes back here in 1263, the debate, and he comes not too long after and reestablishes a small Jewish community on Mount Zion, which was outside the walls, and the 1400, that community will be moved inside the wall, and they will establish the Ramban Synagogue, which we have today underneath the arch. We have in the 15th century, Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura, very famous commentator on the Mishnah, is going to come and strengthen the Sephardic community. But the real change in the demographics of Jerusalem, of Israel, is going to take place under the Ottomans. Remember I mentioned the Ottomans come in 1516. And this, of course, coincides, as I mentioned previously, with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, of which many tens of thousands are going to come to Turkey. Okay, in Turkey, there's no question in my mind, right? I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Turkey becomes this great world power. And we talked about also previously that Sfat in the 16th century is going to explode. There's going to be a golden age. One generation of a huge growth in population of Sfat, up to 10,000 people, and the Ari, and all of these great Talmudic, Kabbalistic scholars. And of course, unfortunately, that's going to fade as the Turkish Empire goes into decline again in the late 16th century. So we have groups of Jews coming back to the land of Israel. One group of Jews very relevant to Jerusalem in the Old City in the year 1700. You guys see where where the Chorva Synagogue is? Above the Ramban is the arch. In back of there is an area that hasn't been rebuilt. There's a synagogue called the Menachem Tzion Synagogue. That's one of the few places they really didn't reconstruct. They just cleaned it up. That area was one of the original inhabited areas within the walls of the city for a Jewish community. In 1700, there was a guy by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Chachasid. And he was Chachasid, not meaning he's a Chassid, because 1700 is even before the Baal Shem Tov is really starting Chassidut. He is actually considered to be a messianic sort of follower of Shabtai Tzvi, who comes to the land of Israel with a bunch of followers. He walks from Poland, an Ashkenazi follower, and he buys up he rents a plot of land in what is the area of the Chorva Synagogue with the Arch. He dies soon after the community goes bankrupt, and that area is going to be more or less deserted. There's going to be attempts to revitalize the community there, but it more or less stays in ruins until the mid-19th century when they build that big synagogue, which is what the arch is the remnant of. That's called the Chorva or Beit Yaakov Synagogue because it was much of the money came from the Rothschild family, named after Jacob Rothschild. But that area is called the Chorva because it was an area with a Jewish community that was impoverished and it sat in ruin. But that's one of the first reestablishments of a Jewish community in the walls of the Old City. We also have in the mid-1700s, a student of the Baal Shem Tov by the name of Gershon Kitover is going to start the first Hasidic community. So we have Ashkenazic, Hasidic, all these communities. And we're talking about what the Jewish community of the 18th century, it's going to be called the Old Yeshuv. Yeshuv means settlement. You can go on Or HaChaim Street, there's a museum called the Old Yeshuv Court Museum, which is still owned by the family that has held that house since for many, many generations, since before the War of Independence. Anyone been inside? It's an interesting museum. You can get a good sense of what it looks like. The spiritual leader of the Old Yeshuv was Shmuel Salant. The Salant family, a very big Jewish dynasty. Most of the Jews of the Old Yeshuv, this is before Zionism, were almost all religious Jews. usually concentrating in the four holy cities of the land of Israel, which are Jerusalem, Hebron, Tzfat, and Tiberias. Why there? A, because of the sanctity of the places, and B, because almost all of these people lived off of a charity system, donations from Europe. It's called the Chalukah. People living in absolute, living here at the time, you think, you know, like the people who live on Kol El Pe today have it rough. People who lived on Kol El Pe in the 19th century had it much rougher. We're talking about people living really in tremendous poverty. Okay, so that's, so the early we have to appreciate the early resettlement of the land of Israel is a purely religious thing. People wanting to be back in what is the spiritual center of the Jewish world. Way before secular Zionism is going to come across. And we're talking about a small return, limited and basically poor community. We're not talking about the big waves of return that are going to happen later on. Whoop. Now, in the early, prior to the first Aliyah, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes, the population of Israel, we don't have an exact census, between 300,000 and 400,000 people were living in Israel towards the latter, in the last, towards the latter half of the 19th century, of whom the majority were Muslims, like 200,000. And you had something like, we don't know exactly, about 30 to 40,000 Jews and another 40, 50,000 Christians living in the land of Israel. Of course, the demographics have changed dramatically in the last 100 years due to the rebirth of the state of Israel. When Israel starts to be resettled, actually, in terms of where Jews are going to move to outside of the holy cities, it's going to be the coastal plain of Israel, which is why we have all of these cities. Of course, most notably places like Tel Aviv and Haifa, which is actually quite old. Tel Aviv is a new city, founded on a sand dune north of Jaffa, close to 100 years ago. But the reason why the Jews are going to start resettling on this coastal plain is because after the Crusades, the Muslims, people like Salah ad-Din and people came after, fearing that the Crusaders would come back and use the coastal plain as a beachhead to repossess the land of Israel, systematically destroyed virtually everything built. All the fort, you go to Caesarea, there's a big Crusader fortress that they leveled it, all on the coast, and the whole place was basically not inhabited. Okay, so it was land that may have been owned. It was either land that was not owned by anyone or owned by absentee landlords, but no one was living there. So in the early Zionist movement, you'll see that they're going to buy those pieces of land up first, and therefore that the re-inhabitation of Israel is going to be take place on the coastal plain. Between 1880 and 1914, which is what we call the first Aliyah, especially in 1880, we'll talk about it in a minute, there's going to be a huge number of people coming back to the country. 60,000 Jews are going to make Aliyah and found 60 settlements. Okay, so this is where we're getting into the period of modern Zionist history. And I want to talk about a couple of the major personalities who are very important when we look at this period of time. One is Moses Montefiore. People heard of Moses Montefiore? You can go to Montefiore lived from 1784 to 1787. 103 years. Lived a ripe old age. He made his killing following and investing along with the Rothschilds. Mayor Amschel, remember Mayor Amschel, the Rothschild, who was one of the first Jews to really make it big. And the Rothschilds cleaned up in the Napoleonic War. They used carrier pigeons. They knew about the victory of Waterloo before anyone else. They made a killing on the English stock market. Mayor Amschel, who I believe was from Frankfurt, who began his life as a minor moneylender in the Frankfurt ghetto, is going to be, within one generation, he's going to set up his five sons. And if you look at the Rothschild coat of arms, if you go to the, where can you see a great example of it? Go to the square in, not the main square, but Rothschild Square in the Jewish quarter, with that building with all the arches, two floors of arches. And the top is the Rothschild coat of arms, which is the shield with the five arrows going through it, indicating that he puts each of his five sons into a major European city and sets up a branch of his family bank, which becomes one of the largest, most prosperous banks in the world. So he's a real Jewish success story. But Moses Montefiore makes his money on the coattails of the Rothschilds. He retires at age 40 and dedicates his life to philanthropy. He was a tireless worker for the Jewish community of Israel. He came here seven times. He's the person who builds some of the earliest settlements outside the walls. The earliest settlement outside Jerusalem, you have to appreciate that Jerusalem in the late 19th century was the old city. Okay, no one lived outside the walls because the Turkish Empire was in such a bad state and there was so much lawlessness that you didn't want to be running around in some open fields outside the walls. But the city was incredibly overcrowded. Now already, by the way, by 1880 or so, the majority of the population of Jerusalem is already Jewish. Out of something like 11,000 inhabitants, 7,000 are already Jewish. And most of the Jews, you should appreciate, lived in what is today the Muslim quarter. The main entrance to the city for Jews was through Damascus Gate, and of the close to 60 synagogues in the old city, most of them were in the Muslim quarter, in a line with the Gold Dome, being that's the site where the Holy of Holies was. So got to appreciate the demographics were very different than they are today. But it was a very overcrowded, squalid place. Most of the land was owned by absentee Arab landlords, The poverty was very extreme. It was very unsanitary. So Montefiore gives money to build. You know where the windmill is? Below the windmill, which is a windmill, which is actually supposed to be a functioning windmill that never really worked. He wanted to windmill it. The Jews could grind their own grain instead of paying the Arabs to grind their grain. He wanted to encourage Jewish industry. He builds the windmill and he builds a guest house, which is called Mishkanot Shananim. And then we'll see in the next few decades, there's going to be a whole series of neighborhoods built. If you just can follow in your mind, follow along Mishkanot Shananim to Yemin Moshe, which is a really ritzy place to live now, named after Moshe, meaning Moses Montefiore. This is the first area of settlement outside the walls, which, by the way, was so dangerous that at night people would still come in to sleep inside the walls. Followed by Machane Yisrael, which is right in the area where the new Hilton Hotel is. Followed by Nachalat Shiva, which is Yol Solomon Street, which is a really cool, trendy place to hang out. And going all the way, I'm making a straight line, if you could picture in your mind where this is, crossing Jaffa Road and going up to Beit Tichon and going into Meisharim. This is all the area of resettlement in Jerusalem, which was where Jewish money was put in mostly to build housing because the population was increasing tremendously. So this is the birth of the new city. Anyway, that's Moses Montefiore, tireless supporter of the Jewish people. The most important personality in terms of supporting the old Yishuv is Baron Edmund de Rothschild, 1845 to 1934, who's a man who more than anyone else financially made the rebirth of Israel possible, a man who spent a huge amount of his own personal money, estimated he spent 70 million francs on the land of Israel, a man who, by the way, had no real interest because the Rothschilds were quite assimilated after a couple generations, a man who had no real interest in Israel, but he met a guy by the name of Rabbi Shmuel Mohi Lever, who lived also in the 19th century, who was one of the first religious Zionists, who was a Lithuanian rabbi, and initially the Zionist movement was a joint operation between religious and secular. It's later going to split, and the religious are going to leave, but Mohi Lever was one of the original really zealous religious Zionists of the 19th century, who manages to convert Edmund de Rothschild to his ideology. And once Edmund de Rothschild also sees Israel as an investment. He puts a lot of money, 70 million francs. He sets up Rosh Pina, which was not his original establishment. If you know Rosh Pina is the base of Tzfat, he saves that community more or less financially. Zichron Yaakov, named after his father, Jacob Rothschild. That name Yaakov appears everywhere because he's a big member of the Rothschild family. Rishon LeZion, the Carmel wineries. Okay, these are all the Rothschild families. This is a way of him investing money in Israel and hopefully making a return and investing in Israel in some industry that will yield some, you know, income for the Jewish people. Yeah.
The Carmel winery?
Yeah, it's his. That's his. They have.
You shouldn't
be too proud of that. Why? It's gotten better. It's gotten better. Since we had the Golan, the wine's improved tremendously. But so important, this guy, when you talk about the halukah of money coming from outside Israel, chutzlars, to pay for the... It wasn't just support or building projects. He just gave a huge amount of money to charity. Huge amount of money. And the halukah was a whole industry. You know, the people who ran it and gave out the money. It's funny, you see like the Jewish agency, like the mafia begins in Israel long before with this period of time. He's so well known. His name, he's called Hanadiv HaYadua. And if you go to, I believe it's Zichron, he has a beautiful garden there where he's buried. There's a family tomb there. But Hanadiv HaNadua is, Nadiv is the giver. HaYadua is the known giver. That's like his title. Such an important character was he. The most important institution, we talk about the rebirth of, you know, political, not the rebirth, the birth of political Zionism. And we have to appreciate, when we talk about the topic of Zionism now, that the notion of Jews living in the land of Israel is not something that was invented in the late 19th century. We have to always keep in mind that traditional Jewish worldview places Jerusalem at the center. Even though we're physically not here, you know, like Yehuda Halevi said so beautifully, Libi b'mizrach v'ani b'sof ma'arav. My heart is in the east, but I'm in the most far west. Or as Rabbi Nachum of Breslov said, Kol asher ani noseh, ani noseh be'eretz Yisrael. Wherever I go, I'm always going to Israel. You see it in all the poetry, you know, Imesh Kachech Yerushalayim, if I forget the Jerusalem. It's always been central in the Jewish worldview that Jerusalem is the spiritual center of the Jewish people, where we turn to pray, where we're meant to be ultimately, where our national potential will be fulfilled. But as a practical reality, it's not going to really take place until the birth of modern Zionism. But we shouldn't think that this, you know, this was a new idea coming to the land of Israel. Zionism, more than anything else, the notion of the national Jew, political entity, that is a relatively modern phenomenon, which definitely is going to grow out of the spirit of the times. The zeitgeist in Europe in the 19th century following Napoleon is the rebirth of nationalism. And the Jews, having suffered through anti-Semitism, as we see, remember we talked about the Dreyfus trial, right? We mentioned the Dreyfus trial, didn't we? Did we not talk about it? We did. You see that, like a guy like Herzl, we're going to talk about in a minute, the spirit of the times is we too, like everyone else in Europe, need a national homeland. And you should know that some early Zionists, thinkers, had absolutely no specific interest in the land of Israel, being that they were very disconnected from Judaism. They just wanted a place where the Jews can create a national Jewish identity. Many of them, however, knew that that national identity should be linked to the historic homeland of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So the idea of living land of Israel is not new, but the modern manifestation politics definitely is a product of the last 100 or so years. The main organization involved in modern political Zionism is an organization called Chobev Zion, the Lovers of Zion. And the founding organization is actually called Chibat Zion. Chibat, Chobev and Chibat are derived from the same word. It's founded in 1870. Those people who were in Chibat Zion were called Chobev Zion. The major personality that we look at and we study Chobev Zion is a guy by the name of Leon Pinsker. Leon Pinsker was one of the early secular Zionist leaders. He started out as one of the Maskilim, one of those people who was into like creating a Slavic Jewish culture in Eastern Europe, being disillusioned, as most of these people were, by the pogroms in Europe, like following the assassination of Tsar Alexander in 1881, all the pogroms that followed. Most of them moved to the only solution for Jewish identity is to go live in our own national homeland. So Leon Pinsker published a pamphlet called Auto-Emancipation, which I'll read you something from in a minute. And we already see by this period of time, the last two decades of the 19th century, they're going to take this ideology of nationalism and translate it into a reality of moving physically to the land of Israel. The first people who are going to do that is an organization called BILU in 1882. BILU is an acronym for Beit Yisrael Lechu Venelech. Okay, and the actual, and I always say the biggest problem with BILU, this is from Naftali Schiff says this, is the whole sentence is Beit Yisrael Vehu Venelech Be'or Hashem. House of Israel, come let us go in the light of God. And I see as one of the many, we see as a common idea of national fulfillment without spiritual fulfillment has been one of the plagues of, I think, much of the modern Jewish identity connected to the land of Israel. But these people are going to settle in the land of Israel. Starting in 1882, we have what's called the first Aliyah. Aliyah meaning to go up. Today when you come live in Israel, you make Aliyah. The idea is associated with not that you're physically traveling north or coming up a mountain, although coming to Jerusalem is definitely called Ole HaRegel. You're going up to Jerusalem, but the connotation is obviously spiritual. So this is going to be the first of what are a number of Aliyot, massive waves of immigration into the land of Israel. So this is the first secular, modern, Zionistic move to return to the land of Israel. And these people, these Bilu Nikim, as they call them, these Bilu guys, very dedicated ideologically. I want to read you. This is a quote from a letter from Zev Dubnov, who in 1885 to 1940, a member of Bilu, he wrote this in 1882 to his brother Simon, Dubnov is a very famous Jewish historian. This is, by the way, from Conor Cruz O'Brien's book, The Siege. I highly recommend it. It's on your reading list. Excellent book about the modern history of Israel and Zionism. And just to give you a taste of the ideology of these people. My final purpose is to take possession of Palestine and to restore to the Jews the political independence for which they have now been deprived for 2,000 years. Don't laugh. It is not a mirage. It does not matter if that splendid day will come in 50 years' time or more. A period of 50 years is no more than a moment of time for such an undertaking. And one thing you see is, first of all, overwhelmingly, it's a political idea linked to historical connections to the land of Israel. And you're talking about people who are coming to a part of the world that is very not pleasant, very, very difficult. You read what people like David Ben-Gurion, our friend David Green from Plunsk, Poland, writes about living here and the famines and the poverty. To be here at that time, would that the modern Israeli was so ideologically inclined as these people, 110 years ago. Now, we have to appreciate what's the orthodox reaction to Zionism? There were definitely Orthodox Jews like Yehuda Alkali, 1798 to 1878, and Rabbi Zevi Kalischer from the same period of time of Posen, who were Orthodox Jewish spiritual leaders who were definitely into the idea of reestablishing Jewish presence in the land of Israel and making sort of a union with the more secular nationalists. There were other people like Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum, who's the Yismach Moshe, who took a more sort of like the Haredi-ish approach of that we shouldn't force the issue. When God's ready, we'll go back. Okay, so there's definitely a split within the Jewish world as to how to back, whether or not to back the modern movement. But more importantly, the reason why Zionism is going to become overwhelmingly a secular movement is because there's going to be a lot of antagonism on the part of, just as we see with Reform and Orthodox, there's going to be a lot of antagonism on the part of, secular, more modern, nationalistic Zionist leaders towards the religious and their view of religious Judaism as being antiquated and something that's meant for diaspora. And this is going to have a huge impact on the Zionist movement and a huge impact. I mean, you want to look at today, the controversy. You know, they say this guy, these Haredim are anti-Zionist, whatever. It all goes back to understanding the roots of the split going back 100 years ago. In the eyes of most of the secular Zionist leaders, the goal of the land of Israel was not to create a religious rebirth of the Jewish people at all. It was to create a national rebirth of the Jew. And if you look at the writings of these early Zionist leaders, many of whom were maskilim, these, you know, right, intellectual, assimilated Eastern European people who were mostly raised religious but went off, and most of them talk about the creation of sort of a Zionist elite in the land of Israel, an intellectual elite, not a refuge for millions of Jews to come pouring into, but a place where the Jew can actualize his potential, the new Jew. And it's interesting, you look at the modern Zionists of this period of time, they often refer to themselves as Hebrews, not Jews. Just as religion was meant for the ghetto in Europe, and Jew was a religious identity of the Jew in Europe with that ghetto, we will create a modern, national, secular, enlightened Jew of the 20th or 19th centuries who will be Hebrew. So there's a whole deliberate switch to a national identity. And this is obviously going to antagonize the traditional Jewish world. From its very inception, they had a very different idea about what Israel was supposed to be. I always say that you can see this in Hatikva. You guys know the words to Hatikva? One of the sentences, Liot am chofshi b'artzenu, to be a free people in our land. The biggest problem I have with Hatikva, and it's a beautiful song, is that one word, chofshi. If they had just taken out to be free, from, which is a national thing, to be free, to be, you know, a modern Hebrew, as opposed to be Liot am kadosh, to be a holy people in our land. That would be it. But that's, you know, one word is not the problem here. It's the starting point of these peoples is very, very different. Leon Pinsker, we just mentioned, who publishes this pamphlet, Auto-Emancipation, one of the leading members of Chibat Zion, who's buried, by the way. His tomb is up, if I'm not mistaken, if you go to Hebrew University, the Botanical Gardens, where they found the tombs of Nicanor, the guy who dedicated the gates of the temple, he is buried in there. They put him in there and there's a plaque outside, very interesting. But he's from 1821 to 1891. He was a Polish doctor. He was shocked by the pogroms in Europe and very disillusioned by what was going on. He's going to become one of the leading intellectual movers and shakers behind the Zionist movement. I want to read you something from his pamphlet, Auto-Emancipation, which is one of the most important documents you can study if you're studying the history of Zionism. He says, "We must reconcile ourselves to the idea that the other nations, by reason of their inherent natural antagonism, will forever reject us." Okay? Now, we have to also appreciate that he was trying to appeal to Western European Jews, but the real interest in Zionism is going to come primarily from Eastern European Jews, because in the West, Jews were more or less comfortable. In the East, where the situation is much worse, the interest in getting out of Russia is going to be much greater, and the interest in Zionism and establishing a physical presence in Israel is going to have a lot more support. It's wrong to assume that Zionism is a product of Theodor Herzl, by the way. When we talk about Herzl, we'll understand why he is so associated with modern Zionism, but it begins very much as an Eastern European movement because of the much more difficult situation that Jews in Eastern Europe are involved in. Another person is Moses Lillian Bloom, 1843 to 1910, who was born Orthodox, became a big socialist. And, of course, many of the founding fathers of modern Zionism were very left-inclined in the terms of economic worldview, socialists, communists, which goes a long way to explaining the socialist-communist sort of Eastern European mentality that Israel has even until today economically, state control. I came from, as a graduate student in Russia, to Israel with a brief stopover back in America to eat some good food and do my laundry. But when I got here, having been in Russia for 6 months, I immediately, believe me, this place was, even at its worst, was much better than Russia, but I immediately appreciated where they got their attitude from. Or you have to spend a little time in a real communist disaster area like Russia before the fall of communism, and today it isn't any better, it's even worse, to appreciate where they get the attitude from. But we have a core group of these intellectuals, and in 1884, November 6th, they hold what is really the first Zionist conference before Herzl in 1897, the Katowice Conference, which was in Basel. and was attended by 36 Eastern European Zionist leaders. This is really we see the Zionist movement starts to coalesce. Before I look at Herzl, by the way, I want to just read you, just gives you an idea, because we have to appreciate really the issue of the modern split in the state of Israel between religious, non-Zionists, and Zionists. We have to appreciate how deep is the animosity. Today we all hear from the news, because the news in Israel is obviously secular and very leftist and almost overwhelmingly anti-religious, so they have no problem attacking the Orthodox establishment. But if you read what the secular Zionist establishment writes about the religious, you realize why it is the religious world is so much on the defensive and reacts the way it does. I want to read you. This is something which, when I had to read this like three times. I was so shocked. This is Chaim Nachum Bialik. Chaim Nachum Bialik is one of the most important figures in modern Hebrew literature. He was raised religious. There's a great story they tell about Bialik. When Bialik was a yeshiva student who went off, as in most of these people, he knew his Bible very well. He wrote a book called Sefer Agadah with Ravnitsky, another great Jewish literary figure of the last century and early this century. Sefer Agadah is a great compilation. Most people don't have it in their houses, religious houses, because it was written by these two guys who, you could see that they actually knew their Torah very well. It's a compilation of all the Agadic stories that take place in all of Torah. Fantastic book, by the way. Translated to Hebrew. It's not in Aramaic or anything. A very good book to own. As a writer, he wrote, after the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, we talked about that one of the first state-sponsored pogroms of Russia in the early 20th century, which so shocked the Jewish world. He wrote a book called The City of Slaughter. And he's describing the horrors of what's going on in Kishinev. And you look at the language and you look at the attitude that he has, which is a mirror of the attitude of much of the secular Zionist establishment towards the religious. And I want to read you this. It's really creepy. He's talking about the slaughter, and he talks about what the Russians are doing and killing all the people. And he says, crouched husbands, bridegrooms, brothers peering through the cracks. Watch the sacred bodies struggling underneath the bestial breath. He's talking about the rape of the women, right? Stifled in filth and swallowing their blood, the lecherous rabble portioning for booty, their kindred and their flesh. Crushed in their shame, they saw it all. They did not stir nor move. They did not pluck their eyes out. They beat not their brains against the wall. Perhaps each watcher had in his heart to pray, a miracle, O Lord, and spare my skin this day. Those who survived this foulness, who from their blood awoke, beheld their life polluted, the light of their world gone out. How did their menfolk bear it? How did they bear this yoke? They crawled forth from their holes. They fled to the house of the Lord. They offered thanks to him and sweet benedictory word. The Kohanim, descendants of the priestly family, sallied forth to the rabbi's house. They flittered. Tell me, O rabbi, tell me, is my own wife permitted? Meaning she was raped. Can I now have a relationship with her? The matter ends in nothing more, and all is as was before. Come now, and I will bring you there to their lairs. He's talking about the Jews now. Their privies, jakes, and pig pens, where the heirs of the Hasmoneans lay with trembling knees, concealed and cowering, the sons of the Maccabees. The seed of saints, the scion of lions, who cram by scores in all the sanctuaries of their shame, so sanctified my name. It was the flight of mice they fled, the scurry of roaches was their flight. They died like dogs, and they were dead. This is heavy stuff. I mean, look what he's describing. Pig pens and rat holes, and what's the image? This is the proud Jewish people, the descendants of King David and the Maccabees, hiding, peering, watching their wives being raped. This is what the Jewish world has been reduced to. And the image is not like they're pitiful. The image is of absolute disgust. It's clear. I mean, this is what the Jews become. We don't want this. We don't want these religious, ghettoized religious. I mean, it's seething with hatred. They hate. The language used to describe the Jews in this poem is far worse than the language used to describe the Gentiles. And the disgust is far greater. From the Gentiles, we understand it. From the Jews, we don't. And we have to appreciate this is not a unique occurrence. This comes from a whole attitude of people who deliberately went off. There's a great story I tell about Chaim Nachum Bialik. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's humorous that Bialik, a lot of guys were literally leaving yeshiva and becoming fry, going off the derech, as we say. There's a great story that on Friday night, the mashkiach of the yeshiva he's studying in, he's walking by a room and he sees smoke coming out, someone smoking, because the window's open. And he goes in the room and he finds three yeshiva guys smoking on Friday night on Shabbos. And one of them, they see the Mashkiach and like, oop. One of them says, oh, I forgot it was Shabbos. Knowing that if you don't know it's Shabbos and you're putter, you know? The other one says, oh, I forgot you can't smoke. And Chaim Nachum Bialik says, oh, I forgot to close the window. So, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but where there's smoke, there's fire, so to speak. But what we see is, I want to pick up with Herzl next class, but what we see is clearly, on one hand, on the good side, an attempt by Jews of Eastern Europe finally realizing that there's no escape from anti-Semitism through any amount of assimilation to recreate, in the spirit of the times, a Jewish national presence in the land of Israel. But on the negative side, unfortunately, it had a lot of baggage with it. A lot of animosity towards Jewish identity and traditional format, and that's going to cause a huge amount of problems for us when we go and try and actually physically recreate our state.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a free cassette catalog, in the U.S. call toll-free 1-800-VOICES-3. Our email address is voices@aish.edu, or write to us at P.O. Box 14149, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.